of idols are easier to avoid because they present themselves as idolatrous. But it's the idols that society heroicizes and glorifies that sometimes are harder to avoid. And sometimes it's the very values that we're bred upon and we celebrate that if taken to an excess and not proportionately can become idolatrous and paganistic and can adulterate the purity of our Masorah. You're all living in that generation. Take a seat, sit at our table. You're all 250 years downstream from one of the greatest events in human history. 1776, the first modern democracy is born. And it's not just the American Revolution, but the American Revolution is the climax of an incredible intellectual ferment for dozens of years about the freedom of man as human beings struggle to replace cruel and abusive forms of government with egalitarian forms of fraternity and freedom, protecting human rights. And it's not just a political movement, but the political movement is manifestation of great thinkers who have been contemplating man's search for freedom for years. People like, you may have read them in high school, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, great thinkers. This all explodes in the latter half of the 18th century, liberating man from the tyranny and abuse of outworn, exploitative, feudal systems of government, releasing his energy, both economically and existentially, and ushering in the great modern period of democracy. We live addicted to democracy. It's hallowed as the ultimate, absolute achievement of modern man. And you'd be surprised to discover how much of our democratic values pose challenges to our Masorah that you've studied so fervently and so lovingly today. So as I mentioned at the outset, it's the molten images that are easy to avoid because they're idols. It's easy to see a golden calf as humiliating mocking of our own misplaced religious interest. But it's when our values are taken too excessively and become idolatrous that they're harder to discern. So what are the dangers of growing up in the 21st century under the spell, the hypnotic spell, of democratic societies? Well, first of all, it's the very notion that democracy is the ultimate form of government. Mirtz Hashem, in about an hour, we'll all daven ma'ariv, and we won't be praying for a democracy, we'll be praying for a monarchy. We're not davening for a caucus of human opinion steered by David HaMelech. Mashiach will be a Melech. And as much as we see democracy as the most progressive and equitable form of government that human beings can fashion, still terribly flawed. It's flawed politically. Log jams. Inability to legislate. Hitler and Stalin both challenged democracies in the previous century, suggesting that democracy was too ineffective to defeat absolutist evil, whether it was Nazism or communism. He dared democracies to be effective enough and efficient enough to oppose him. Thank God we were able to. They're flawed socially. Most of you, I think, if you're in the United States of America, you can feel the social tensions that are erupting based on the polarization of our political system. Inability to respect and appreciate other people's views rather than dismissing them and attacking the people who purvey those views. And of course, it's not just flawed politically and socially, it's also flawed religiously. At some level, the Melech has to not just serve as a politician and tactician, but also a role model. And sadly enough, whether you support Donald Trump politically in his policies or you oppose him, I don't think anyone in this room would dare to present him as a role model for any basic human decency, respect of other human beings, minorities, handicaps, women. It's sad. But that's the fallout of democracy. And the Melech's job is not just to legislate and not just to supervise the people, but to serve as a role model. That's why he can't have too many horses, can't have too many wives, because he has to serve as a paradigm of Yirat Shamayim, Levilti Yasser Levavo. He shouldn't turn his heart away from his responsibility as a role model. But it's not just that democracy creates social fissures, absence of morality sometimes on the part of our leaders. It's also the very notion that human beings and human devices can create perfection and create utopia. There's a certain cockiness that democracy has introduced that has started to spread outside of the political arena, that human beings are capable of authoring their own redemption. And to a degree we are, and we've improved our world, and there's no question that the Industrial Revolution is a cousin of democracy, and the Industrial Revolution and the advent and the great leaps of technology have greatly and vastly improved the human condition. But then there are events that remind us how dependent we are upon HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They pull back the veil of invulnerability that we sometimes create for ourselves. And democracy almost hypnotizes us into believing that we are capable. And this is Parshas Noach, one of the great failures of Migdal Babel. The failure of the Dor HaMabul is obvious. Complete moral degeneracy. Absolute ethical collapse. Violation of all moral norms. Adultery, theft, murder. Why were the people of Migdal Babel, why were they punished? There's such fraternity and solidarity. In part because they excelled so incredibly technologically, the technology of their day, which was creating bricks from mortar. When you have bricks, then you can have a multi-story building. If you're just building houses of reeds or houses of mud, you can't build multi-story buildings. You're much more vulnerable to a flood. Having witnessed the horror of the flood, they wanted to build tall skyscrapers. You're going to build tall skyscrapers with solid foundations. Solid foundations have to be created from cement, from bricks, which have to be forged in a furnace. It was the technology there. They discovered the power of fire. Not to burn and to destroy, but to create. They became so confident in their technology, they no longer needed God. There was a great German poet who once said, his name was Goethe, that before man had the skill to move mountains, he needed the faith to move mountains. The more skill you have, sometimes the less faith you have. And it's that illusion of independence. And the illusion, thank you, of invulnerability sometimes becomes too human-centered and less dependent upon a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So when you say Modim tonight, you say, Al-Misecha Shebuchal Yom Imanu, Gyal Niflo Secha V'tav V'secha Shebuchaleis, Erev Avokev V'tzarayim. Remember, every breath you take, every moment of chemical and hormonal and psychological balance, every moment you don't get into an accident, the moments you never know about, near misses, it's because the Kodesh Baruch Hu is steering. And he provides that veneer of invulnerability because he wants you to be confident and he wants you to feel that you're self-sufficient, because then you can dream, you can believe in human talent. But as long as you clock in and remember, it's yours. So democracy creates that challenge. The challenge that as successful as we've been in crafting through human hands our own success, both politically as well as in all realms of human experience, as successful as we've been, we have to remain and retain that sense of independence upon HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Then there's a second challenge. The Bill of Rights, the rights of man, life, freedom, pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, equality. What are my rights? How can government protect those rights? Very heady and very grandiose thoughts. And for thousands of years, your rights were irrelevant to despotic, tyrannical rulers. And finally, in the modern era, your rights are protected. And the protection of your rights allows you to live a richer life, a deeper life, more meaningful, hopefully spiritually, more selfless, more noble. But it also creates a mind space. As if your life is meant to live your rights. Is that how we define ourselves? We're people of rights? We're not people of rights, we're people of duty. We're people of responsibility. When the Mesillas Yesharim, one of the great, great Svarim, it predates the Muslim movement evolves in the 19th century. But the Mesillas Yesharim, or Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, an Italian, a great Italian mystic, wrote what became the first great Musar Sefer. I'm sure some of you have begun reading it already. In the early 18th century, he introduces his Sefer, I am here to detail Ma Chovas Ha'adam Yolamo. What are my responsibilities in this world? Ma Chovas Adam Yolamo. How much of your religion has become emulsified? How much of your religion has become wedded to modern convenience? And that's why you practice it, because it provides it with value and meaning and depth. and redemption and purpose and content. That's not what religion is. Religion is to be an Eved Hashem. When's the last time, I ask you the following question, everyone listen. When's the last time you did something religiously that was hard? It was really difficult. That was a sacrifice. It wasn't in your interest in any general fashion. Because you knew it would provide you with knowledge or information or value or redemption or meaning or... When's the last time you really took it? Went to the mat for Avodas Hashem. Did something really difficult. Because you saw yourself as Avram sees himself in next week's parasha when Hashem tells him to leave his background, his family, his culture, lock, stock, and barrel. He walks away. He's an Eved Hashem. Or Hashem tells Avram in the end of Vayera, sacrifice not just your son, but your legacy, and not just your legacy, but your whole reputation, because after all, you can imagine the tabloids, right? This great, great pietist and priest who was pontificating to us about morality and ethics, he's a hypocrite, right? You scratch a saint, you get a sinner. He's a hypocrite. He's a murderer. Can you imagine everyone mocking him and scoffing at him, right? He didn't care. God's command was more important to him. So how much do we see ourselves? I mean, it's laughable sometimes when you see people in America and in Western society, the litigious societies that have been created. What are my rights? And my rights have been abused. And I don't know, Rev Jake is here, so he's probably the only one in this room who remembers about 20 years ago. Probably the most offensive moment in which we saw the dangers of a litigious society was someone walked into McDonald's, remember? And they ordered some coffee. And the coffee spilled on their pants or on their leg or something, and they sued McDonald's for a multi-million dollar suit because the coffee burnt them. You're a patron. You bought some coffee. You're a klutz. Call it a day and move on. What are my rights? That's why every coffee you order in Starbucks has the little sleeve with the warning so that they... Right, so they can protect themselves legally. Now you know where it started. Hassan Shmagegi sued McDonald's, and all society lined up and said his rights have been violated. What a sad day for human identity. Really? That's how you live? What are my rights? I'm not just interested in how you live theoretically in the political spectrum. How do you live tonight? It's now 6 o'clock. You have 4 or 5 hours. You're going to eat dinner. You're going to daven Maariv. You're going to go to class. What's in your mind? What you deserve? What you can do? How you can help, how you can receive. Think about the interaction between democracy and capitalism, because they're basically twins. The next time you read, those of you who are economically oriented, about the consumer confidence and consumer price index and Black Friday and Cyber Monday, we're Bami Shalom. We're consumers. God forbid, that's how you define yourself as a consumer? You're put on this earth to consume? My bracha to you is you should leave this earth having produced more than you consumed. Then you will have led a noble life. You have to consume, you have to eat, you have to earn a living. If you leave this earth having consumed more than you produced, then it's a tragedy. And if you live your life as a consumer, then it's a tragedy. Are all being hypnotized because of the sanctity of human rights and defending human rights. And then there's the consequence of rights. Because if my rights are protected, my freedom is also protected. There's a very great Hasidic rabbi called Rabbi Netzadok HaKohen of Lublin. You may have heard him quoted in some of the shiurim. I'm sure you will hear him quoted. He once claimed that the Dor HaMabul was punished not because of their moral decadence, because they were too successful economically. The Medrash says they were still superhuman. You see, it was still some segue between Gan Eden and the modern period. It's almost as if there were three conditions to the state of our world. In Gan Eden, everything was supernatural. Man never sinned. Everything had incredible potential. Nature collaborated with man. You didn't have to work. Then Adam gets punished and he has to work. And Cain gets punished. He has to be a nomad. But the earth still maintains some of that supernatural potential, even through the Dor HaMabul. And then when the Mabul comes, the Mabul reboots the earth into the fallen state we know it to be in. Of course, what's the only country the Mabul didn't affect? You're living in Gan Eden. Literally, the rocks under your feet haven't been affected by the Mabul. You just got off a plane 6 weeks ago from Teaneck, you're in Mabul world. You're in the rebooted world, you're in the world version 3. Here, you're in the world version 1, unaffected by any fall or any deterioration of the human spirit. So Rebbeinu Tzaddik says they lived an incredible period. The Medrash says they would have to plant their crops once every 40 years. Imagine if you're planting your crops once every 40 years, the earth would produce sufficient bounty to last 40 years. Great! 39 years free! Liberated from labor! Liberated from the field! What do you do with those 39 years? Are you listening? Rebbeinu Tzaddik says, then their failure was they had too much leisure time. They didn't know how to use their leisure time properly. So for them, having too much time on their hands, they fell into moral disgrace. Could you imagine if Rebbeinu Tzaddik would walk into the 21st century and you'd show him your endless entertainment device? Don't let anyone ever herald Steve Jobs as a great hero of American industry. Edison was. Discovered electricity. Marconi was, not American, Italian. They discovered technology and ideas that changed the human experience and improved it. Steve Jobs just enabled us to entertain ourselves around the clock. And that's the outcome of industrialization wedded to democracy. We no longer have to clean our clothing manually. We no longer have to sow our crops manually. We're able to create more prosperity, thank God. People don't die anymore in a civilized world because of poverty or hunger, thank God. But it's liberated us from the toll of work and given us so much leisure time. Remember I told you before one of your accomplishments in life, and hopefully you'll start working on it this year, is to be a producer more than a consumer? Here's another challenge for this year. Try to take a few steps back from your culture and ask yourself, do I enjoy the culture and the entertainment it provides? Or am I addicted to it? I imagine most of you are carrying an addiction. And I'll tell you how to know whether you're addicted to it or you just enjoy it. When your team loses a really big game, if you feel a pit in your stomach, you're probably on the wrong side of the addictive scale. If you enjoy watching athletic feats, it's interesting. You enjoy watching movies. Obviously, another way to gauge your addiction is how much time you spend. Be careful. I know this. You can work with your rebbes and your madrichim. Nothing wrong with entertainment. But it's meant to be a diversion. Not a full-time occupation, a full-time engagement. Someone told me that ESPN is on the verge of corporate collapse. It's a good thing. ESPN introduced the notion of sports 24 hours a day. All the people who created sports are turning in their graves. William Naismith is turning in his grave. That's not what I intended. 24 hours, it's a diversion. You work, you study, you help, you raise your family, you're religious. At a certain point, your mind and your resources are taxed beyond their capacity, so you relax a little bit. Endless relaxation. Endless leisure. So that's the second question of democracy. Do we live for rights? Do we live for leisure? Do we live for duty? It's very scary. Duty shouldn't be something scary. It should be something ennobling. Work. Think about the last time you worked hard at something, you felt a better person. Chazal tells us that Hashem tells Avram, go to a land and you'll know when you get there. Al Eretz Asher Eka. So the message is Avram travels through Lebanon and Syria, and everyone's enjoying themselves, festive meals, sumptuous feasts. Then he comes to Israel. You know what he sees? People are just working. They're plowing, they're planting, they're harvesting. This is where I want to be. I want to be right here. According to this message, Avram chooses Israel, not because of any supernatural, metaphysical holiness. Because people have a good work ethic. Can you become someone who enjoys work? Who lives for duty? Realizes the nobility of having responsibility? ultimately, when you join communities, that's the price of entry. We're going to have a family one day. If they're working, they can sacrifice your sleep and sacrifice your money and sacrifice your interest to get married because you have to live with someone else and you have to compromise. Look how much you get in return. People are unwilling to make that sacrifice because it's all about them. They live very, very sad, very, very dark, and very, very narrow lifestyles because they can't live for anything beyond themselves. And then all they have is themselves. I'm sure during the first month, there are a couple of guys in this room who came over to some of the rebbeim and said, why is the rule of Leif HaTorah so-and-so? That rule doesn't fit me. I do better through this rule. I do better if I take him here. In some cases, the rebbe said, no, you don't understand. It's probably better for you. You just don't understand it yet. Follow the rule. You'll see it's enhancing. But sometimes the answer is, you know what? It may not be beneficial for you. But it's beneficial for the overall community here. And to be part of this community, you have to conform to the rules. Sometimes in life, there's a price for entering something larger than yourself. Where would you rather learn this year? In a yeshiva of one? If you made a yeshiva for yourself, you could shape the rules exactly to fit your needs. But you wouldn't have the resources and the richness that you currently have. Sometimes, to receive something larger than yourself, you have to pay the price of submission. You have to pay the price of compromise, of extending yourself. So are we a people of rights? Are we a people of duty? Are we a people of leisure? Are we a people of work? And then there's a third danger. Because democracy, thank God, spoke of the equality of man. And that equality is, of course, in his identity, existentially, even independent of politics. As I said before, people who wrote about this weren't just describing political systems, they were describing who we are as people. But that has to express itself primarily in the political arena. One vote per each person. Each person has an equal vote, and it took about 150 years for that to be expanded to all colors, and a little bit longer for it to be expanded to all genders. And in some ways, we're still not at the stage in our cultural discourse that we afford the proper respect to people of different ethnicities and people of different gender. It's certainly something you should see as part of your Avodas Hashem. Avodas Hashem is not just how many tefillin on and how many daven of the Gemara you learn, but do you treat people with respect? Regardless of their race, regardless of their religion, regardless of their gender. Unfortunately, the type of communication that takes place in today's world is very hostile and very disrespectful and very aggressive and very demeaning. There's no room for that. If you're a firm person, you're a firm person, not just when you're opening in front of a safer, but when you're talking to everyone in the street. So you speak kindly and you speak positively. But there's a danger in creating equality, because if each person is equal politically, then perhaps each person is also equal in their viewpoints and their perspectives. I'll give you a fancy word for that. It's called moral relativism. The abolition of any absolute moral concept. And I'll give you an example, a very sad example, that the world is first learning to escape from. That person, he's not really a terrorist who homicidically murdered 50 people. Yet see the world from his perspective. He grew up in a refugee camp. His people were subjugated by the occupying power. He was displaced. He had to emigrate. And he was transported from his homeland, from a position of prestige. And now we have to, it's all legitimate. We have to identify with people who are refugees. But to validate murder? Is there anything that would happen to you in this earth that would justify your murdering another person short of self-defense? The answer is no. Person is actively engaged in murdering you at this moment. Here's the din of Rabbah. Anything else? You can labor to resolve it. You could try to correct it. It's all morally relativistic. And not just in the political arena, how we treat terror, but in other decisions that human beings are making. That person's view of sexuality. It's another person's view of sexuality. In a hierarchical world, where there's a melech, there's a clear sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's value as the center of value. Now, there are questions. If this is Hashem's value, why does that person feel that way? What does that person express his identity that way? These are all questions that have to be answered and people have to be treated with respect. But it starts with an absolute fixed value. The value in the Torah, the value of our halacha, the value of the Masara you studied about today. And then we try to adapt the value and explore the value and understand its resonance and relevance. What happens when you live in a spinning world of moral relativism? Each person's view is just as legitimate as the next. To a degree, that's the confusion that Donald Trump tried to capitalize upon. He realized that people were so angry with this moral relativism without a simple black and white set of values. Of course, he came riding and offering a very abusive and unfair racist set of values. And he capitalized on people simmering anger. But the anger is legitimate. The anger was caused based on people sensing that the world had been overturned. That no values reigned supreme. There was no absolute system. And that's really an offshoot or a byproduct of democracy. Each person's vote is equal. And each person's opinion is equal. I want to make sure I have to stop 2-3 minutes. So we've talked about whether human beings can create perfection. And we've talked about whether you live for rights or you live for duty. And we spoke about the dangers of moral relativism without absolute fixed values starting the conversation. And of course, as the title suggests, another danger is the danger of humanism. For thousands of years, people didn't see themselves at the heart of their world. Because they were subjugated, imprisoned, taxed, lorded over. So they weren't necessarily looking for something else, some other identity, some other... Democracy is fueled by the spirit of humanism. Respect for humanity, respecting the fact that people are different. And here's the challenge, and I want everyone to listen carefully. Don't let anyone tell you that you can't be a religious humanist. I know a lot of you will find yourself in locations over the next couple years in which you sense a very powerful stream of humanism. And that's perfectly synthesizable with your Avodas Hashem. Every human being has a Tzelem Elokim. Every human being has dreams and hopes. You should respect and help and appreciate every human being you meet and try to find the kind and the noble within them. That's part of your Avodas Hashem as well. But when humanism suggests that at the heart of identity is human logic, human experience, empiricism, that's where it veers and deviates. To be an Oved Hashem, you have to be capable of a wisdom that goes beyond intellect. What's the wisdom beyond intellect? It's called faith. Shlomo HaMelech, David HaMelech says, Reishis Chachma Yiras Hashem. You're not smart because you score high on a test. You're a wise man if you can find people whose truths you trust and can embrace even without self-mediation. Even if you can't prove it yourself. Can I prove how the world was created? Let me tell you, a great rabbi that I learned with. He also taught some of the other people in this yeshiva, including the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Boaz Mori. You may have heard him mention Rabbi Amital, maybe once or twice. He would say every year, around this time, when we'd ask him questions about Bria'as Olam and about Noach and about the age of the earth and all these very, very tantalizing questions, he would tell us in our yeshiva, which at least then was known as a very, very intellectually curious yeshiva, open-minded, he would say, and I'll tell you in Hebrew, Ani lo mevin ma ze big bang, ma ze small bang. Ani matchil lekroat ha-Torah mi parshat lech lecha. I don't know Big Bang and Small Bang. I start reading the Torah from Parshas Lech. I don't know Bereishis. I don't know Noach at all. I know one thing. Hashem told Avram to go to Eretz Yisrael to introduce moral concepts. Avram, listen. I try to be like Avram. If you trust your own intellect to discover the truths and only accept the truth that you'll mediate, you'll be lost. Some of them we can prove. Some of them we can't. Some of the questions have answers. Some of the answers lie beyond human ability. If you ask most people that are older than you who seem to be more successful religiously, they'll probably tell you they have more questions than they had 20 years ago. It's not about answering your questions. It's about having shoulders broad enough to live with questions. And that's where faith kicks in. When I put my head down at night and I have questions about religion, I don't think of a math formula or philosophical book that I've read or math equation. I think about my rebbes and their rebbes and their rebbes. I think about my grandparents and their grandparents. And maybe I'll resolve some of the questions they didn't. Maybe I won't. Maybe some of the questions they resolved, I'll. But I can accept their traditions and their wisdom without having to reinvent the wheel and internalize it based on my own limited cognition. That's a big turnaround for a world that's addicted to intellect. Not to embarrass anyone in this room, but if anyone in this room is a valedictorian, just know you've been victimized. Why in the world would a school want to hand out an award based on how many brain cells you have? That's equivalent to handing out an award based on who has the nicest nose. It's bizarre. If I were made principal of a school in America, my first executive decision would be to abolish valedictory awards. And if they hand out awards, they hand it out to the person of the greatest character. I would assemble a list of 10 values and traits that are important to character. Selflessness, tenacity, courage, helpfulness, kindness, religious, whatever they are. And we grade each person. The boy or girl who scores highest on that scale would be awarded best student or best person. You know the greatest victims are? The valedictorian. Because he or she has been told their whole life about how great they are. And all that applause and praise probably masks a lot of unattended character development. Because they think they're great. You're not a valedictorian, you have to actually become a good person. And you know what? The victimization continues. Because then you get a really great job, you get accepted to a great university, you have a lot of zeros on your salary, and then you wake up one day and you're 50 years old and you look in the mirror. It's a very fancy mirror, because it's gold-plated, because you're very wealthy, but you're looking at a ghost. And then you have to start assembling a personality. And that's not easy. So it's when human intellect becomes the seat of human identity that humanism becomes very, very hazardous to Avodas Hashem. So we're going to take a break now. That's Dabba Mincha. Take a break now. Remember those four aspects. We thank Hashem that He gave human beings the ability to discover democracy. And it's Hashem who started. Not Jean-Jacques Rousseau or Thomas Hobbes or Thomas Jefferson or George Washington. V'chol ma'aminim, what do we say? Shehu levadahu, He's exclusive. Who can continue the v'chol ma'aminim? What's the mem? Hamamlech, melachim, v'lo amlucha. Hashem gave human beings political instinct. And Hashem allowed human beings to discover superior forms of governance. It's Hashem's gift to humanity. We thank Hashem. And every gift can become toxic. And every gift, when applied to an excess, can become worse than the idols that you read about in Tanakh, as you don't quite sense that they're idols. Okay, so we'll take a break now. We'll see you in a few minutes.
I got a lot of